The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Brian Mahan is with me, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, and Megan Scully, the broadcaster. You're both very welcome. Brian, what has Cabinet agreed when it comes to the social welfare that is paid to Ukrainians?
So basically, any of the Ukrainians who arrived here before March are now going to have their social welfare cut from, I think, 230, 240 to 38 euro a week. It's not all of the Ukrainians who are here. I think it's those who are still in state-backed accommodation who aren't working. I think there's about 25 to 30,000 of them. Okay.
So we have Ukrainians who've arrived since March. They're on a reduced rate anyway.
They're on the 38,
And everyone who arrived from the outbreak of war up until March was on this higher rate. Mm-hmm. Some of those are working. Some of those are out, have sourced their own accommodation. Some of them kind of living with families have opened up their rooms. Those who are still in hotels or guest houses on the state's dime, as it were, they're the people who are going to fall foul of this, is it?
Yeah. So Ivana Bachik has said today that she has real concerns that this would end up targeting, you know, the most vulnerable of Ukrainians, those who have children, those who are physically unable to work. But I think the only way I can interpret this move from the government is that they're saying to quote unquote lazy Ukrainians or Ukrainians who have yet to work after being here for 2 years, get a move on. And I think the other crucial thing to remember here is you have this big crisis with the asylum seekers. So we're expecting about 20,000 this year. But the great unsaid thing throughout that whole debate over the last month or so is that we have 85 to 100,000 Ukrainians. So if we didn't have the Ukrainians here, would the asylum seeker issue be as big a political issue? It would still be an issue, but I don't think it would be as big as it is at the moment.
Yeah, quite possibly it wouldn't be as pronounced. But does Ivana Bachik, Megan, have a point that, you know, predominantly it is women and children more than men fleeing the war? And if you do have some of those who have young kids with them, and because of that, it's impossible for them to work, or certainly it's very, very hard for them to find work, and very hard for them maybe to find accommodation that's suitable if they've got a few kids with different ages as well. And suddenly now the state is turning around and saying, you know, we're reducing your income to 30 odd quid a week.
Yeah, I think she's absolutely correct there, because, you know, I've been to visit some places where Ukrainians are staying, and you know, this kind of, I guess, temporary accommodation, and it was mainly women and children I met. And as you mentioned, it was women with children of various ages, babies, and, you know, it's hard for them, no more than anyone in Ireland, no matter if you're Ukrainian or not. When you have small children, it is very hard to get out. And then, you know, childcare costs as well, we already know, are extortionate in this country. So if you're trying to rear a family and then you're living in emergency accommodation, as you mentioned, trying to find accommodation is near next to impossible. So it isn't just as simple as giving them 36, 38 euro a week and then just saying, OK, we'll just get a job. It's not that easy. I think there has to be some sort of a system put in place where they can return to work, almost like job seekers, what we do here for a lot of people, where you can get a certain amount of money and then maybe start reduced or put a plan in place to maybe get these people into jobs, maybe get them into temporary work. I know the hospitality sector is crying out for people, and see, can we set up a system where we can get them back to work? And I think then maybe we can start to reduce it slowly. But as you mentioned, for those, I think, who can work and who maybe don't have children, we should be getting them into jobs straight away.
Brian?
I think what we also need to remember is from when the new rules for the Ukrainians arrived after March, the government has been kind of touting its success there, that Ukrainians are either leaving state-backed accommodation or not arriving in as great a numbers, much depleted numbers. And I think that is what the government is doing here, is trying to send a very clear signal to Ukrainians, is you got to get working, or perhaps you might think, well, is there somewhere else in Europe you can go? Because the problem is,
And listen, I understand that coming from a logistical point of view and from a very kind of cold, calculating, mathematic point of view. You know, we've got a budget we've got to try and stick with. And this is costing a huge amount of money. Yeah. I mean, we're talking upwards of 2 billion euro a year on these supports. And that money doesn't grow on trees. We know that. At the same time, to make this decision in the same week that Russia opens a new front in the war, it seems a bit callous, arguably a bit callous, to kind of turn around and say, well, you can always go home.
Well, the flip side of it is when this was the issue in March was done, there was a great quote in the Irish Mail on Sunday that my political editor, John Lee, got, which was, it was, the government said it was the original sin to give Ukrainians the full whack of the social welfare, because actually most European EU member states didn't give Ukrainians the full social welfare rate. And there was a bit of kind of, you know, I had a friend who asked me these kind of questions. Why did the Irish do that? I genuinely didn't have the answer as to why that was. Did civil servants back in 2015, when the Act was brought in, never think that it would actually be used? Mm-hmm. Because other European countries didn't have the same social welfare entitlements for Ukrainians.
Catherine says, can someone clarify the Ukrainian thing? I have a girl living with me since last year. She hasn't got work. She gets the 232, 232 quid a week. And the government gives me 800 for the pleasure of hosting her. Will her weekly rate drop? Will her rental allowance be cut? Very vague and affects many people.
I think in the first instance, anyone who's in that accommodation where they're living with an Irish person, their social welfare rate is not being cut. Whether their other entitlements are being cut, I'm not entirely sure.
All right. Okay. So our understanding, Catherine, is that nothing changes in your circumstance. But that's only our understanding. Yeah. As we say, you get on to somebody maybe who knows more through maybe the local council or through whatever scheme that you found this woman to come and live with you. They might be able to point you in the right direction. James May is one of the former hosts of Top Gear in the UK, along with Richard Hammond and Jeremy Clarkson. What has he been saying about cycling, Megan?
Well, he has been complaining because there is a lot of, they're talking about bringing in more kind of rules and regulations in the UK around cyclists. There's talks of license plates being put onto the bikes. Now, because this is on the back of actually pedestrians being killed and knocked down and badly injured by cyclists. But he's saying that he thinks it's all nonsense, that it shouldn't happen, because he reckons if you're cycling around London, we'll say, for example, you shouldn't be able to reach 20 kilometres per hour. He reckons he does 10 to 12 himself on a good day. I have to say, I probably agree with him on that, because even when I walk around London, like, the traffic is insane. So how anyone can pick up these top speeds on bikes is just beyond me. But the problem is they go into like the likes of the park, the Hyde Park and all these Battersea Park. And he said the cyclists seem to, you know, think that they're in the Tour de France, and they go helter skelter down through these parks. And that's where you have the issues with pedestrians and runners. Mm. And, you know, I used to live in London and I go to Battersea Park quite a lot, and there'd be an awful lot of young children out. There'd be dogs, there'd be elderly people. So you had an awful lot of mix of people. And then if a cyclist is going at 20 kilometres an hour and then a child comes out in front of them, you know, there's going to be serious issues there and serious damage and serious injuries. So but he just thinks it's all ridiculous, which I'm kind of surprised at him. But I suppose on Top Gear, he was always the one that wasn't really into speed, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He wasn't always into speed. And I think he's kind of a keen cyclist as well himself, as you said, around London. Not a very quick cyclist,
yes, but
a keen cyclist. Brian, why I find this kind of interesting is whenever we talk about this type of issue in the show, people will text in with this exact suggestion.
Yeah.
Make them pay tax, make them pay insurance, make them have a license plate on their car, on their bicycle. That'll solve the problem.
Well, I think in this very specific instance that this story refers to, there was a loophole where a cyclist did kill an old woman because they were going at like 30 kilometres an hour. And the loophole is such that this person couldn't be prosecuted, is what I think effectively the British police force said.
Yeah, or they could only be prosecuted under a law that was enacted when Lord Palmerston was the Prime Minister.
Horse and drawn carriages or something.
Yes.
So, I mean, if anyone kills anyone, I think it's perfectly reasonable to prosecute that person, you know? So in this specific instance, should that person be prosecuted? Probably yes. Do we need kind of license plates for cyclists? I don't really think so. If the government and everyone is as serious about the Green Revolution as they say, why would you make it more difficult
It. It creates barriers, actually. If you can't just go out and buy a bicycle and get on the bicycle without seeking out insurance and paying tax on it and getting a license plate, you're just not going to bother.
No, you're not going to bother your behind, basically, I think is the polite way of putting it. I certainly wouldn't.
Megan, one facet as well of this kind of debate whenever it happens that I'm always struck by, again, and it happens in the text line, and 087 1400 106, I should say,
send them in.
The text line number, send them in, is how people kind of retreat into their groups. I am a cyclist. I am a motorist. I am a pedestrian. And nobody ever considers for a moment, sorry, not nobody, the people who text into radio stations. And I'm not criticizing any of you lovely people who are texting into the radio station, but the people texting in never consider that, you know, maybe, you know, the fault kind of lies not in the stars, but in themselves, that maybe actually we could all be a bit safer on the road.
Well, absolutely. You're talking to road safety advocate over here. I have to say, when debates like this happen on X, which was obviously formerly Twitter, I actually sometimes sit back with a cup of tea and scroll through all the messages. Because as you mentioned there, it is literally the drivers versus the cyclists versus the pedestrians versus everyone else. I'm like, you all need to come together. And I've said this before, and I've said it on my own social media when it comes to road safety. We all have responsibility, whether we're walking, whether we're cycling, whether we're on public transport, whether we're driving, whether we're a passenger in a car. And we all have to come together, and we have to kind of consider everyone else that's on the roads. Like, we talk about Ireland, and there isn't like right and proper cycling infrastructure right now. So it does push bikes onto path, but then the path is where you'd have the pedestrians. So it's just at the moment, what we have in Ireland when it comes to infrastructure isn't right for everyone. There isn't really space for everyone. So then we kind of have to decide, okay, be more cautious, look around you. Is there a bike come behind you, in front of you? Is there pedestrians? Everyone has a part to play in this.
I am both a cyclist, not as often as I should, and also a driver. And having been on both sides, like, cars have nearly knocked me down and vans have nearly knocked me down inadvertently. I assume they're not trying to kill me. Mm. But also, like, as a driver.
Is that Brian in front of me?
I remember what he wrote yesterday. He's gone. But like, as a driver, sometimes cyclists, not all cyclists, but sometimes cyclists will pop out ahead of you when they really shouldn't. And I get a bit of road rage, and I have friends who are much bigger motorheads than I am, and they have no time for it. But I also have friends who are obviously cyclists, and they're the full time going, drivers are the devil.
When people are behind the wheel of a car, I mean, they're behind the wheel of a kind of a vehicle that might weigh, I don't know, several hundred kg or upwards of a ton. I'm not quite sure how much a car weighs, but certainly travelling at speed, it is a deadly weapon, much more so than somebody who's walking or even somebody on a bike. Now, they could kill somebody if they hit them in the wrong way going at the right speed. But because of that, you get accused of victim blaming when you suggest that cyclists need to take some responsibility, or pedestrians as well. But the amount of pedestrians, the RSA, 43 or 50 pedestrians, it's in around that mark, killed on the roads last year. How many of them as well are people who walk out because they're staring at a phone in their hand?
You
say that and you're accused of victim blaming because, yes, the pedestrian's not going to kill anyone. It's the person in the car who does the killing. But at the same time, surely you can point out that somebody shouldn't walk out in front of traffic.
That happened to me only the other day. I was walking back from lunch with my friends, and this is not a joke, I was reading up on something from the Road Safety Authority. We're in front of the Oireachtas Committee, and I was reading the phone, stepped out, one foot on the footpath, and the car went bang. And I was like, the irony of that I was reading about road safety and I was just like, you're a moron. So I'm sure I'll get a text from my mother now being like, are you well?
But another issue is
someone else trying to hit you, Brian.
The headphones and the AirPods and the like sound cancelling headphones. I see people in cars driving with their headphones on. Cyclists have the pods or buds or whatever you want to call them in. So do pedestrians. I won't name the city, but I was driving around the city recently and I left my hand over the horn because I was like, I'm going to need this. And I think four times from the entering the city to get to my destination, pedestrians stepped out in front of me. And I was like, are you not looking? And like, you could see they were completely distracted. The phone was in the hand. They probably had the pods or buds or whatever you want to call them in their ears. And it's just like, no, people are not paying attention because everyone is so distracted now, whether they're walking, whether they're cycling or whether they're driving. So everyone just has to take a little bit of a look around and put the phone down. Do you know what actually happened to me recently? And I thought about this in terms of road safety. I was at a communion and my phone was in my bag. And I remember thinking, you know, if you're at Mass and your phone goes off, the sheer and utter embarrassment and like the shame if your phone rings at Mass. So I was thinking, you know, when you're at Mass, you wouldn't look at your phone. So why would you look at your phone when you're driving or walking or cycling?
Yeah.
There isn't that collective shame of 300 people praying to our Lord, I suppose.
Well, you should imagine now you're at Mass.
Yeah, imagine you're at Mass when you get behind the wheel of the car. Anyway, we'll all be accused of victim blaming, given we've had a go at people for being on their phones and walking out in front of traffic. Before you go, I do want to before I talk about the DRS scheme, James May, we kicked off this conversation, talked about him. He's going to be on the show tomorrow to talk about this.
No way.
Yeah, on the Hard Shoulder tomorrow. He of Top Gear fame, so make sure you're tuned in for that from 4 o'clock. So the deposit return scheme usage has gone through the roof, Brian. Breaking all records. Records that they seem to set retrospectively every time they get a new figure, I notice.
Yeah, Return have done this, the company that runs it, have done this on a number of occasions in the last few months, and they're telling us how amazing the scheme is going. And the figures on the face of it look quite impressive. But I think the question that's been asked of me by my editors and my friends and my colleagues is like, how many cans aren't returned? And where is that money going? Because presumably Return or someone has that cash, because the Coca-Cola, for example, they have to provide 15 cent per can to Return.
Mm.
Presumably not every can of Coca-Cola is recycled. Do Return use that as profit or not? I'm not entirely clear on that. But there is a story that we did in the Irish Daily Mail, I think it was in the paper on Monday, and it was a company that exported all of their cans to kind of airports around the world, and fast moving consumer good company. And they were arguing effectively that they shouldn't have to pay the 15 cent because those cans were not going onto the Irish market and they weren't able to get the money back. So they were getting penalised unfairly.
Yeah.
I have seen correspondence from that company that suggested that departments or officials in the Department of the Environment suggested to them that they should set up in Northern Ireland to be able to circumvent the rules. Now, the department, we went to the department for this, and the department have flat out rejected that this ever happened. But we certainly seen the letter to the effect that the company believes that this is the case.
The company believes that because the product that they're producing in this country, mm-hmm. that they're not able to collect that money. So I just want to get this straight. Yeah. So the law around the deposit return, the returning of these goods applies to them because they're operating in this country.
Yeah.
But because of the way in which they operate and where they sell at airports, that it's just impossible for them to be collecting back any of that money.
Yeah.
And so the suggestion from the company is that the department actually told them, well, what you could do is you could set up shop in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Officially, that's where you'd be based, but your operations could still be here.
They could incorporate a company in Northern Ireland,
and then you don't have to put the DRS thing on your cans at all. You're an exempt. You're effectively a product coming from another country.
Yeah, and the company found this outrageous, needless to say, and that's why
lots
they wrote
of people listening will find it outrageous actually as well, which is why I kind of wanted to clarify it.
Yeah.
Megan, how have you found the scheme?
Yeah, so I don't really drink out of plastic bottles because I just don't like the
just glass bottles
taste
with
flavor.
A straw.
No, I have to reuse it. But do you know what actually happened to me recently? I was there filling up my reusable bottle at home and going off drinking water for a few days, not a bother. And then it was pointed out to me that I was drinking yellow water. So I was drinking yellow tap water. I'm not really sure what was going on. So I had to go and buy bottled water because I did not obviously want to drink this yellow water.
What precisely were you drinking? Are you sure it was water?
No idea, but I think it was water.
But it came out of the tap.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I don't know what's going on, but look,
That's what happens when you cross the Shannon.
Yeah.
You don't know what comes out of the taps.
We also had another issue that we reported on where small boutique kind of, they drink, or people who drink kind of their kind of fancy beers, basically. They're all small brewery companies.
Yeah.
And they basically told us that they were given a 30-day notice period to pay this 15 cent per can back to return. And they made the argument, a not unreasonable argument, that almost no business in Ireland works on a 30-day kind of return, like kind of fee-paying policy.
Yeah.
So they were getting massive cash flow issues. So needless to say, I went to return and they came back and went, oh, well, we're happy to talk about that. But we've done all, we've got the 30-day kind of rule after consultation with providers, and you're like, well, I'm talking to a crowd here who say they're really struggling with paying their fees 30 days, kind of with 30 days notice, when most companies are 60, 90, 120 days.
Brian Mahan, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, Megan Scully, broadcaster, thank you both very, very much for joining me.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.